Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. David Lesh, who is a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And his latest book just out is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And the New York Times is carrying a front page story. Rebel arms flow is said to benefit jihadists in Syria. And they suggest that both Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are supplying the Salafists, the hardline Islamic jihadists, as opposed to the secular opposition groups that are more favorable to the United States and the West. What explains that? I mean, these are countries, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are supposed to be our allies.
Well, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, of course, have a history, recent and remote, of supporting more conservative Muslim groups, sometimes Salafists, sometimes not. Of course, the Qataris and the Saudis have received the green light from the United States and the European Union to help supply arms to the opposition, but there's no controlling mechanism on who's getting these arms. The opposition inside Syria is so divided and mixed. It's such a complicated matrix that it's very difficult to determine who exactly is getting the arms. And in fact, there are a number of groups that are basically just following the money. They're not necessarily Salafists, but they're almost portraying themselves as being Salafists, to the point of even growing beards and naming themselves, such as the Ibn Taymiyyah Brigade, after a famous medieval Islamic philosopher who's kind of laid the groundwork for Wahhabi Sunni Islam. You have the Tawhid Brigade, which is a term which is very resonates among Salafist circles. And so these groups are not necessarily Salafists, but they're following the money and then portraying themselves as such because they know that's where they'll get the money. That's when they will get the money, from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the like, and from private organizations and Islamic organizations, especially in the Persian Gulf. So it's even what seems to be more Salafist, in terms of the makeup of some of the opposition in Syria, is probably really in reality less the case. However, there are indeed jihadists that have come into Syria because that's where they cut their teeth. The al-Qaeda types is in situations like this. They have the experience. Some of the bombings against the government installations have all the hallmarks of al-Qaeda type groups who have honed their craft in places like Iraq. You've had now blowback from Iraq of Syrians and other jihadists who went through Syria on their way over to Iraq to attack U.S. Forces and U.S. ally forces after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So they're familiar with the networks in Syria. They're familiar with the landscape. And so many of them are entering back into the country and providing some support to the largely just conservative Sunni Muslim opposition and secular Sunni Muslim opposition that I think as this goes on and as this conflict becomes more militarized and unstable and chaotic, it opens up more doors for some of these Salafists and jihadists to come in.
Well, when you say blowback, Dr. David Lesh, of course, that's blowback against the House of Assad, since during the Iraq War, the Assads encouraged jihadis to go into Iraq and fight against the United States. This does bring into question U.S. policy towards Iraq, and of course, it's become an election year issue between President Obama and both vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. Paul Ryan kept accusing the Obama administration of referring to the Assads as reformers, even though there's no evidence that was ever said by anybody in the administration. So it's become a political issue, but it's still, I think, you have to ask yourself, what is the U.S. policy towards Syria, and what has it been from day one? It seems that our policy is one of avoiding a bad outcome in a post-Assad Syria, but it's not about achieving the right outcome in a post-Assad Syria?
In the beginning, I think a lot of people were hoping, and in terms of wishful thinking, the beginning of the Syrian uprising, that Bashar al-Assad would actually make the necessary reforms and stabilize the situation. That obviously didn't happen. And then the Obama administration and the rest of its European allies decided that he must go a year ago this August. But how do you bring that about without bringing the necessary forces on the ground, which I don't think anyone has the stomach to do right now, because of the asymmetry of power that the government had vis-a-vis the opposition, which has closed certainly over the many months as the opposition, its own learning curve, has gotten better at attacking government forces. But what we see right now is this stalemate, and I think the Obama administration is showing some caution and perhaps even prudent caution in not entering the fray in any more assertive fashion without understanding the landscape. And the specter of Afghanistan looms over everybody right now. What happened in the 1980s after the Soviet invasion, and we started to arm the Mujahideen against the Soviet invasion, and look at the blowback from there, that ultimately for us ended up with 9/11. Even the Saudis are being a little bit circumspect right now because they don't want blowback of jihadists who then, point their guns at the regime in Riyadh, much as what happened in Afghanistan. So you have this specter out there that we have to understand the opposition better. The opposition has to coalesce a great more than they have been. They have to become more coordinated, more unified, and for themselves to offer a vision for the future, which they really have not done, that's inclusive for the many minorities, including Alawites and Christians in the country, and not just the Sunni Muslim majority. And so I think the U.S. has been trying to do their best to try to bring about this more inclusive and a united opposition, but it's very, very difficult because there's so many different groups and there's so many different fault lines amongst the opposition that are decades in the making, and you can't just erase those fault lines in a few months.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and the author of the new book just out, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. So, Turkey, of course, has been taking the lead for some time, and now apparently Turkey is deploying quite a lot of military equipment along that 500-mile border, tanks and troops are right up there, along with aircraft buzzing, and the Turks just intercepted a Syrian airliner that they claim to be carrying Russian arms, and that's led to Turkey banning Syrian overflights over its territory and Syria banning Turkish overflights over its territory. So on the surface, it looks like tensions are building between those two countries. So again, the question would be, David Lesh, since Turkey's been taking the lead, since this is where all the arms transfers take place, and this is also apparently where the U.S. CIA has a presence there, what is the problem with the Turks and the Americans in terms of being able to shape the nature of the Syrian opposition to avoid arming jihadists? Obviously, one thing comes to mind with me, at least, is that so few American specialists speak Arabic. Is that a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think in some cases it is. I think more it's a case of understanding the Syrian landscape and the nature of the opposition. We do have CIA people there in Turkey, perhaps even in Syria itself, in rebel-controlled territories, trying to understand the nature of the opposition and trying to understand to vet them in terms of who can we trust with these weapons, because the last thing we want is to, for anti-aircraft weapons to end up in the hands of jihadists or Salafists and eventually the al-Qaeda types that will be used against Western or U.S. airliners down the road. So we're very, very careful about this. And the Turks are in a very difficult position right now. I mean, they changed their view, obviously, toward Bashar al-Assad. I think Prime Minister Erdogan, when he saw that in the Libyan uprising, when the Libyan rebels started burning Turkish flags because Turkey was late to support the opposition against Gaddafi, that he all of a sudden switched sides and realized he had to be on the right side of history and supporting fellow Sunni Muslims in the Middle East and against the authoritarian regimes. There went out the zero problems policy. Now he has many problems policy in a very complicated situation, and now he has to, they're almost up out there on their own. I mean, they are wishing that the international community of the United States would back them up a little bit more, and they're not going to do more without it. So they're kind of caught in the middle, and the Turkish population in general, I think, polls have shown that they are questioning the policy of the government vis-a-vis Syria. So they're kind of in betwixt and between position, and I think the Syrians know that, and the Syrians have been going after groups just across the border, and they've incurred the expected response from the Turks. But as you know, these things could spiral out of control, and that's one of the main problems for the international community right now is how do you support the opposition without the whole situation, leaking across the borders into Lebanon or into Iraq, and which are equally sectarian as Syria, or involving the Turks more than has already happened.
So Erdogan's government, though, is supposedly, it's referred to as a moderate Islamic party. Is that a fair label? And does Erdogan understand this problem with Salafists and with the Saudis, and particularly the Qataris, supplying them with weapons? Would he be on the side of supplying the more secular Syrian opposition groups, I imagine?
Well, he's on the side of, I think, supporting Sunni Arab and Sunni Muslim groups in general in Syria. And I think they have to be very, very careful. One thing is that most of the Sunni opposition in Syria can be categorized as conservative Muslim. They're not Salafists. They're not Shahadists. Some of these conservative Muslim opposition groups have been, they include some Salafists and Shahadists because they're looking for help. They're looking for assistance in taking on the government. And at this point, they're trying to get it from anywhere. But most of these conservative Sunni Arab Muslims, they see Turkey as a model somewhat. I mean, they're not necessarily against a secular society at all. And they see that, what the Justice and Development Party has done in Turkey as something that maybe could be put in place in Syria. And they're also looking with interest at Egypt and how the Muslim Brotherhood establishes itself there. Will they have a moderate policy that's inclusive and protects minorities? So I think Turkey provides a model for many Syrian groups. Whether or not they can achieve that, of course, is a bigger question, because there are many different types of groups, and it's much more sectarian in Syria than it is in Turkey or Egypt.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesher, who's a professor of Middle East History at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's the author of the new book just out, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Now, assuming the title of your book is correct, and it comes to pass, and obviously the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, for the longest time has been saying that Assad must go and will go, but there's a strange history here in terms of the U.S. Taking down these secular regimes, first with Saddam Hussein, and now, not that the U.S. is actively involved in taking down the Assad regime, but certainly, obviously, wants it to go. Isn't this a little strange, though, that our whole so-called war on terror is focused against bin Laden and Islamic extremism, and yet our foreign policy and the wars that we've fought of late have really been about taking down secular regimes in Iraq, which obviously benefited a religious regime in Iran, taking down we're in the midst of trying to figure out how to take down the Assad regime, which is very secular, and may be replaced by these Salafists we're talking about. And then, of course, there's the example of Libya, where essentially a secular regime, albeit of kleptocrats, was taken down. And now we're worried about jihadis in Benghazi, et cetera. And you can also add to the list the Mubarak regime in Egypt. So is this just accidents of history, or is this some kind of foreign policy blowback?
I think there's a number of foreign policy blunders in what you just mentioned. First and foremost, the taking down of Saddam Hussein enhanced Iran's position in the Middle East immeasurably. And I think the position that the United States has taken towards Syria is a way to counteract that, maybe after the fact and too belatedly, but a way to counteract that, because by removing the most important ally of Iran, we're blooding the nose of Iran itself. And in many ways, as you know, I mean, the Syrian situation has become a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran at a regional level and the United States and Iran and Russia at a large level. And what's interesting is that many Alawites who are very, very secular in Syria, and those Alawites who are in the leading or officials in the government in Syria, they're wondering, they say, what's wrong with the United States? We're secular. Why aren't you supporting us? We're the ones that pursued peace with Israel several different occasions during the regime of Bashar al-Assad. You know, they figure that the Alawites are natural allies of the United States, yet we are supporting, you know, the conservative Sunni Muslim groups that may or may not contain Salafists and jihadists, or may or may not lead to certainly a conservative Sunni Muslim dominated regime if the Assad government falls. So they're wondering, you know, what are we doing? You know, are we obviously we're considering geostrategic interests are trumping what may be in the interests of what's consistent more with our own country's values and principles.
So it's a very confusing landscape, and the article in the New York Times front page, "Rebel Arms Flow," is said to benefit jihadists in Syria. Is a bit of a wake up here, and there's no evidence, as far as I know, from what I've been able to find out, and I know you've been meeting in Washington with groups of people in think tanks interested in what's happening. Is there any sense? As I say, my critique of the U.S. foreign policy towards Syria seems to be that it's focused on avoiding a bad outcome rather than achieving a good outcome. Is that likely to change? Is there any sense that a president who's got his hands full trying to get reelected, is things going to change after this election?
It could. I think obviously if Obama wins, he'll be less hamstrung by the specter of a prospect of another election. And the old saying goes, second term presidents are a little bit more bold in their policies. Does this mean, you know, boots on the ground or establishing no-fly zones in Syria? You know, probably not in the near term. But it may, you know, it may lead to stronger diplomatic action, perhaps more aid to the opposition, in terms of possibly even arms going to the opposition. But, you know, again, I think they're very much wedded to the view that until they understand the situation better in Syria, and until they understand the regional and international implications of involving the U.S. more in terms of providing arms, and certainly in terms of any sort of military intervention beyond that, that it's best to err on the side of caution and let the situation, unfortunately, play out, which is a humanitarian crisis and a moral crisis in many ways. But drawing down from Iraq and in the process of drawing down from Afghanistan, I mean, American polls are very much against another military venture in the Middle East. So I think he will stay true to that and focus on other aspects of the American economy, Iran, and various other countries in the Arab region. As long as Syria, unfortunately, in a Machiavellian way, remains somewhat insulated, I think there's a general trend, the tendency right now to think of a Syrian solution for the Syrian problem, but they may be incapable of doing that, the Syrians themselves, in which case, some outside support at some level. But as long as the balance of forces, I think, continues as they are, we're going to see what I call the Lebanization of Syria, in the sense that it will break apart into various groups, various regions where the government controls certain regions, where the various factions supported by different, potentially different outside countries, control different areas, especially outside the cities, major cities in Syria. And we could have the stalemated situation with a fairly weak or bloodied government, opposition groups with regional powers supporting these different opposition groups, much has happened in Lebanon in the 1980s.
Well, David Lesch, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. All right. Take care, Ian.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesch, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. He's the author of Syrian Foreign Policy in the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And his latest book just out is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined by CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin to talk about the Supreme Court.